wish we could be certain of that, Commissioner.
Oh, yeah? I'll bet you we won't see him again until Doomsday. Get it? Dr. Doom. Doomsday.
Yeah, Ben, we get it. Oh, brother.
Hey there, welcome back to Marvel by the Month, the weekly podcast about the monthly publishing history of Marvel Comics. My name's Brian Stratton.
And I am Rob Milne.
And this week we are going to be talking about the Marvel superhero comics that were published with a cover date of July 1963, which means they hit the newsstands right around May 1963. This episode we're going to be talking about Amazing Spider-Man number 3, Fantastic Four Annual number 1, Fantastic Four number 16, Journey into Mystery, number 94, Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos, number 2, Strange Tales, number 110, Tales of Suspense, number 43, and Tales to Astonish, number 45. This list of stuff is just getting longer and longer.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, I don't know if we really appreciate what we were getting ourselves into when we started doing this. But hey, you know, this is the 17th one of these things we've done, so I think we have no choice but to keep moving forward. Let's hit up a little context for May 1963. First bullet point, not super pleasant, but you know, it's an important thing to realize for the context of the era. So in early May of 63, so this would have been specifically like the 2nd through the 4th. So if you remember, we were talking about this last episode, there were, a lot of, civil rights protests, anti-segregation protests going on in Birmingham, Alabama, at this time. And, it was in May of 63 that hundreds of African Americans who were out there protesting, including children, were arrested, during the Birmingham campaign, as they set out from the 16th Street Baptist Church, to protest segregation. 959 people on May 2nd were arrested on the first day, and 2 days later, the public safety commissioner, and I think all of that should be in air quotes, Eugene Bull Connor, he ordered his men to use dogs and fire hoses to repel new demonstrators who came in to beef up the ranks. This is something where, you know, if you've ever seen documentaries about, you know, the civil rights era, you have probably seen some of these images of just like children and like folks out in their Sunday best, just getting blasted with fire hoses and having dogs set on them. And like, this is what was going on in our country, you know, 50 years ago. You know, you're going to start seeing this, you know, a lot of the civil rights, issues creeping into Marvel Comics as, you know, Stan and Jack Kirby and, you know, all the writers and artists in the bullpen are kind of struggling to figure out, like, hey, if the Marvel universe is the real world, then how do we address this, you know, in a way that doesn't cheapen it, but doesn't shy away from it either. So it's a fine line to walk.
And it seems like they were on the right side of history. From here,
I feel like yeah, they probably had their heads on straight and their hearts in the right place.
Yeah.
By the way, this Birmingham campaign ultimately wound up being successful for its immediate goals. By the 10th of May, which is my dad's birthday, Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the leading business owners of Birmingham, they basically came to a truce, and the SCLC agreed to call off its boycott of the local retailers. And the retailers, in return, agreed that they would desegregate lunch counters, restrooms, fitting rooms, and drinking fountains, and hire more African Americans for sales and clerical jobs. So the protest was successful. It was nonviolent, at least on the protesting side.
Yeah.
So, you know, progress is not easy.
No. Well, on the 5th of May, after 18 years of denial, the Soviet Union confirmed that it had recovered and identified the burned remains of Adolf Hitler on April 30th, 1945. So for 18 years, they had this information but did not share it. So previously, the official Soviet position had been that of the Soviet commander I don't know how to say his name, Georgi Zhukov, who had said, "We have found nobody definitely identified as Hitler's. For all we know, he may be in Spain or Argentina."
Way to throw Spain and Argentina straight under the bus.
Right. I mean, granted, there were some Nazis who did flee to different countries, but come on.
Yes. Yeah.
So in other words, they had the burned remains of Hitler for that whole time.
Yeah. What a weird thing to conceal, but I guess the Cold War was a weird thing. So yeah, there you go. In a little bit of entertainment news, on the 8th of May, Dr. No, the first James Bond film, premiered in the United States, and Mr. Sean Connery, Sir Sean Connery, I believe he's a sir.
I think he's a sir.
Yeah. He was the first Bond, in the first movie. So this is kind of relevant also because, you know, Nick Fury has his own comic book right now. You know, in this month, you know, we'll talk about that briefly, but it's not long before Nick Fury has another comic book, which is a lot more James Bondy. Mm-hmm. And this is a major reason why. So these films started coming out. They were wildly popular. And, you know, Marvel will take inspiration from anything that's in the popular consciousness.
And the Cold War was, you know, a great time for spies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Man. And on the 14th, which is of May, which is my friend Thaddeus's birthday.
Hey, happy birthday, Thaddeus.
The Rolling Stones signed their first recording contract. So another member of that invasion of Britishness.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, you've got the Beatles are already out there doing their thing. They released their debut album in America. Now the Rolling Stones have signed a contract. So, yeah, the popular culture is changing in a big way. Marvel's a big part of it. And they are going to, again, continue to pull inspiration from everywhere that they possibly can. So that's what's going on when these issues are on the stands. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to do a quick recap of some of the issues. So stick around. We'll be right back.
All right. Let's get into the recaps.
All right. Sounds good.
So let's start with Fantastic Four, number 16, The Micro World of Dr. Doom.
Oh, yeah.
So we have the return of Doom. Once again, Doom was not killed. I'm not going to say it. So Dr. Doom returns. In his last appearance, he was shrunk into nothingness with his own shrink ray. He wound up in the micro world of Subatomica. First appearance of what will be known as the Microverse.
Yes.
So if you are familiar with the Micronauts or any of the other things that happen later,
yep,
this is where it first starts.
Yes, the Psycho Man. He's from the Microverse, right?
I think like, so. He's like, he from the... Well, we're going to spin off.
I know,
is he from the Negative Zone? I don't know.
Who knows? Yeah.
So interestingly, he built a new shrink ray and has been using it against the FF the Microverse.
From the Microverse. And I love this. So and the way that we know this is because Johnny Storm, as the issue opens, he's flying back into the Baxter building and he sees Reed and Sue and Ben, and they're all teeny tiny. They're getting sucked into an air duct. And so he melts the ducts so that they don't get pulled in. And then each of them admits to the others, it's like, yeah, this isn't the first time I've been tiny lately.
We just didn't want to say it.
Which is such, again, like covering up Hitler's remains. Like, what a weird thing to conceal. I mean, did you really think that, like, with the company you keep, you think this is the strangest thing that they would have heard that week? You
know? And embarrassed by it
way. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I suddenly shrank to the size of an action figure, and I didn't, but it seems normal now, and I didn't want to tell anybody. So,
yeah. Right. Yeah, so there you go.
So guess who appears, though, in this shrinking episode?
Yeah, well, if you're all about figuring out why things are getting much smaller than they should be, you're going to call
Ant-Man.
Yep, and he antipults his way over onto a pair of flying ants, which fly him to the Baxter building. So he's getting slightly more efficient about his modes of conveyance.
And also, nice aim.
Yeah, perfect aim.
Reed calls him, of course, calls Ant-Man. to help figure out what's going on, probably using ants. when the FF disappears, he follows them to Subatomica.
Yeah, so the FF gets a little sample of Ant-Man's shrinking formula and enlarging formula, and so they use that to get Tiny to figure out what's going on, because Reed's got a conjecture that's like, hey, if we can shrink down, maybe we can figure out what's going on here. And they do, and they wind up in Subatomica, where Dr. Doom has basically taken everything over.
Of course he has.
Because that's what he does.
And also, the Subatomica is a classic weird Kirby universe, yep, of course, with exotic and unknown types of seating and sculpture and architecture.
Yep.
I feel like Kirby just whipped up new worlds, you know, between cigarettes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's great. So the FF gets down there. You know, they get captured by Doom. They get themselves out of the predicament, of course. Ant-Man shrinks down. He's like, I'm going to help them out. Immediately gets beaten up and like has no, you know, like is no assistance whatsoever in their struggle. But the FF manages to sort things out. They free the micro world from Dr. Doom. Doom makes a run for it, and the grateful tiny citizens of Microworlds thank the FF as they go back to regular size, and that's probably the last we'll hear of Dr. Doom.
Yep, there are some hilarious little there's it's worth a look if you've got the time. There's some funny little things in this comic with some what might happen as slaves, as the Fantastic Four as, yes, slaves, just mainly Sue with like the worst hair.
Yeah,
that was how they wanted to say how bad it was going to be.
Yeah,
so
she was going to look like, you know, she hadn't had a chance to hit the beauty salon in several months.
Yep. All right, that's that.
Okay, cool. Well, let's go to something Fantastic Four adjacent. We'll jump into Strange Tales 110. So this is a Human Torch solo story. The Human Torch versus the Wizard and Paste Pot Pete. So the
he's
most
back.
The most fun villain name to say he's returned. Wizard still doesn't have his wizardy armor, but these guys are like, you know, neither one of us was able to be successful, but I bet if we team up, we can multiply our incompetence.
And guess what?
It totally worked. Pete winds up breaking the Wizard out of jail. They decide that they're going to team up. They're going to take out the Human Torch. Now, if you remember, so Torch has fought Wizard a couple times, and beat him both times. He fought Pastepot Pete once and Pete got away. So,
yeah,
you know, Pete's actually on a pretty good run right now, but he's going to roll those dice again. and Wizard goes back to a plan that he's used before, where he's got that suit that duplicates the Torch's powers. He's going to try to ruin his reputation. They go back and forth. There's, you know, some hijinks, and ultimately they wind up capturing the Torch and they trap him in a hall of mirrors, I believe, in the Wizard's house.
He's just got a lot of space.
Yeah, well, everything. This is the third time, I think, that the Torch has wound up getting stuck in the Wizard's house. Like, he's really proud of this thing.
And his house is cool.
His house is very sweet.
It just seems like you should use that room for something else. Maybe billiards.
Right. And also, it's kind of a weird gimmick. Like, you can tell why they give him a suit of armor at a certain point. It's like, you know, his gimmick can't be that he's got a crazy house. That doesn't really jive at all. So,
yeah. And it's worth mentioning that Pastepot Pete takes some initiative and gets the Wizard out of jail.
Yes.
So,
yep.
You know, the Wizard, of course, says, I was about to get out myself anyway.
Right.
But thanks, Pete.
Yeah. Yep. Pete has not taken the initiative to get himself a better villain name yet, but that's coming.
Yep.
Surprise, surprise. The Torch winds up escaping from the Hall of Mirrors and he captures both of them. So not only does the Wizard go back to jail, but this time, you know, Pete has to face justice for his crimes. So, you know, pretty by the numbers, you know, solo Human Torch adventure, you know, one that is, quote, plotted, unquote, by Stan Lee. And was it R. Burns or H.E. Huntley? One of those two.
And it does have a little more of a straightforward plot than a Libra plot. But
totally. Yep.
Also, Ayers did the art. Yeah. So you have, mm-hmm. you do have a different take. I've noticed this, as other, artists take up the villains, yeah. they get a little less grotesque.
Yes.
So Wizard's face gets like maybe three quarters as long as it yeah. was before.
He doesn't look like a half a horse.
Yeah. People look a little more human.
Right.
And that's it, right? I mean, Strange Tales.
Well, Hey, so the name of the book is Strange Tales. So let's introduce Doctor Strange.
What? Not the Doctor Strange we met before.
Not
right?
the Doctor Strange that Iron Man fought and who promised he would make his triumphant return. That guy never shows up again. But this is, we don't know this yet, but this is Dr. Stephen Strange, the master of the mystic arts. So there's no origin in this story. We don't really know anything about him except that he's into black magic.
Cool.
The name of the story is Dr. Strange, Master of Black Magic. So he's not the Sorcerer Supreme. He's not any of that. This is kind of a really sort of straight up, it's very much in the style of what some of these other like Strange Tales stories were, like these science fiction fantasy stories, you know, a little bit of Comics Code approved witchery. But you know, nothing too satanic. So basically it's just the story is there's a man, he's been having these recurring nightmares. He comes to Doctor Strange for help. So Doctor Strange does his thing, he uses his magical abilities to enter the man's dreams. And he confronts a supernatural being who we will eventually know as Nightmare, but he's not named in this story. In his confrontation of Nightmare, he finds out that the man is being haunted by other men that he has ruined in business. It doesn't say that he's done anything illegal to them. He just says that he's ruined them. So, maybe he's just being cutthroat and is feeling bad about it. I'm not sure. You know, they're careful not to say that he's, you know, that he has he's broken the law in any way. He does, I'm pretty sure attempted murder is still breaking the law.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he when he realizes that Strange has figured out his secret or, his, you know, the thing he's guilty about, Dr. Strange's physical body is in a trance and he has projected himself into the dreams, the man pulls a gun and is going to kill Dr. Strange. But the master, Dr. Strange, the person who Doctor Strange refers to as the master, who we will later know as the Ancient One, he winds up intervening, opens up the amulet that Strange wears, which stops the man in his tracks. Strange returns to his own body, disarms the man, boom, and we're out.
Yeah, there's a lot of little hints. The amulet, of course, is an eye.
Yep.
Maybe you've heard of the Eye of Agamotto.
Maybe.
He has a lot of it. I mean, this is Doctor Strange. He's got his weird leopardy gloves.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's got his cowl, but but he's got the amulet. He's got the white streaks in his hair. He's got
some beautiful Steve Ditko art.
Yep.
Ditko's stuff is so creepy.
Nightmare is creepy.
Nightmare looks great. Yeah. Nightmare looks straight up like Sandman.
Yeah, and also exactly as Nightmare looks now.
Yeah.
So a character is fully realized and brought into this side story that I didn't expect.
Yeah.
I thought I was just going to read another Johnny Storm and then I'm out.
Yeah, yeah.
Suddenly Doctor Strange pops up.
Yep.
It was great.
It was really good. Let's do a quick touch on Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. Again, we mentioned when we introduced them a couple episodes ago, this is not a book that we're going to do deep dives on because it's set, you know, 20 years earlier than everything else in the Marvel Universe. It's important just in the context that Nick Fury and a few of these other characters do wind up coming forward into the Marvel Universe, but they're not really there yet. And this is really kind of a straight up just... It's a war comic. It's a genre that's not really represented today. So it doesn't quite fit in with the rest of the stuff.
Yeah, it does inform, you know, what Marvel thinks is important subjects to touch upon.
Yes.
From that past.
Yeah.
So here we go. Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos, number 2, Seven Doomed Men. I get to say doom all the time.
Doom.
another blood and guts World War II story featuring Fury and his Allied commandos. They have to disrupt the Nazis' attempt to build an atomic bomb.
Yes, because this is going to be Fury's commanding officer says, I can't tell you what this project is, but whoever finishes it first is going to win the war.
Right. And they allude to the Manhattan Project, yep. And heavy water is what Fury's trying to get a hold of.
Yes.
Before that, it starts off with Fury and the commandos just blowing up a bunch of U-boats. So that's nice.
Right.
So they go through a whole mission with no sleep and then are immediately sent out to stop this.
Yes. Yes.
This nuclear bomb creation. So part of their plan involves getting sent to and then liberating a concentration camp.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
I was actually kind of shocked that they went there. I have not read a lot of war comics of the era, so I wasn't sure, like, hey, I mean, is there a lot of explicit reference to the concentration camps? But if you remember, like, I think we've talked about this before, that Kirby in his military service actually was, he liberated a camp when he was in active duty. So
I believe he was one of the first, not the first, but mm-hmm. but I one of the first groups to do that from what we talked about before.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, obviously a lot of this is informed by Kirby's own service, and Stan Lee also, you know, he did some active service, but Kirby was really, you know, in the blood and the mud. It's very much of its era. Doesn't really touch on a lot of the rest of the Marvel universe, but it's a script by Stan and Stan alone, art by Kirby and Dick Ayers inks him. So it's a good story for what it is, and it's a nice looking story too.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing, knowing that Kirby's been through what he has been through personally, seeing these shots is really interesting, like what he chooses to draw, how the people in the foreground and how gaunt and in the camp and then also how the gang and Nick Fury refer to the Nazis and the treatment of the camp, let's say guests in the most quotes ever. Really interesting.
Yeah, it is. And you know, also like keeping in mind that Stan and Jack were both Jewish. So like this, you know, had added resonance when they talk about this stuff, like there is a lot of weight behind it too. So, all right, cool. So there's three other issues that I think we can just kind of talk through real quickly. Mm-hmm. They're not bad, but there's not necessarily, you know, a lot to them. So there's, I'll just do a real quick recap of Journey into Mystery, number 94, featuring the mighty Thor. Thor and Loki attack the human race. What? Story opens with, Thor being at the beck and call of the military industrial complex, as he has been weirdly often so far. But he's chasing down some runaway rockets that are not auto-destructing as they're supposed to be. Loki's watching him do all this while being chained up in Asgard. Over the course of this, he uses his magic and causes Thor's hammer to hit Thor's chromosomatic gland, which determines and changes personality. So it's literally a hit on the head, change your personality story.
Classic Gilligan's Island.
Exactly. So this turns Thor evil. He busts Loki out of Asgard, the two of them start causing some chaos on Earth, and they're demanding that the gods surrender Asgard to them and let them rule it. And they're going to keep messing things up. Basically, like, they just go through, you know, all across the globe, just like destroying like landmark after landmark.
Yeah, the Taj Mahal, the Eiffel Tower, just trashed. Where I'm reading it going,
yeah,
whoa, you guys are trashing pretty, and the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
Yeah,
they like tidal waves. Thor causes more stuff than we thought he could cause.
Right.
It's just also it's worth mentioning Thor pushes over the Leaning Tower of Pisa with one finger.
One finger.
His pinky.
Yep. Anyway, so the gods they come up with a plan to put a stop to all this, and it's a brilliant plan. They trick Thor into getting hit with his hammer in the head again. Which reverses the personality switch. Yeah, so Thor is back to being good Thor. He captures Loki, and Loki gets locked up again. And that's basically that.
One other, just one note for hilarity's
sake. Oh, yeah.
the gods disguise themselves as the members of the UN.
Yes.
And bring Loki and Thor in and then pull off the rubber masks. Just another classic Scooby-Doo move. So a little bit more highbrow. Let's go to Tales to Astonish, number 45.
Are you just saying it's highbrow because it features a man named Egghead?
Yeah. It also features a henchman named Ape. So let's just balance that out.
Right.
So,
and a full page spread of an anteater.
Yes, I forgot about that. Oh, it's so good. Which is, of course, the mortal enemy of Ant-Man.
Right. Well, yeah.
You think Egghead's bad. There's an anteater in this story. So this is Tales to Astonish number 45, The Terrible Traps of Egghead. So again, recurring villains. We've seen this. We're seeing this more. So Egghead is still in the Bowery Flophouse he wound up in at the end of his last appearance.
Yes, when his willpower was shattered by Ant-Man defeating him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How could that happen?
Yeah. And seriously, if Ant-Man beat me, I would be pretty depressed too.
I would probably just, hang out in the Bowery too.
Yeah.
He hears about the Wasp from some crooks and helps them hatch a plan to defeat her and Ant-Man.
Yes. And part of this plan, which I love, is that he disguises himself and establishes himself as Professor Carl Stryker, zoologist, which, and his like disguising himself, basically he grows out some stubble and then like puts a couple like patchy hair pieces on.
And a cravat.
Yes.
So Egghead creates a trap for the Wasp by hiding a stolen pendant in a Wasp exhibit and assumes naturally that the Wasp will come to this exhibit.
Right.
Because you're called the Wasp.
Exactly.
And he's right. So,
I mean, points to him.
he captures her to lure Ant-Man, but Ant-Man defeats an anteater, a lizard, and Egghead's thugs to save Wasp. Egghead's plan is foiled, but he escapes.
Yes. So that actually winds up becoming kind of a recurring thing with Egghead, is that he's a very tricky guy for Ant-Man to actually put away. Just as Ant-Man is a very low-stakes superhero, Egghead is basically a very low-stakes Doctor Doom.
Yeah, and and even more obsessive. So
yes.
That's the funny thing about this issue is that Egghead has these thugs, and they steal this like priceless pendant, and they're like, all right, we're out. We're done for life. We just got this. And he's like, no, this is just phase one to attract... to get the Wasp to come back to this thing, to get the anteater to eat Ant-Man, blah. And they're like, what? We're dumb guys. And we're saying we could just be done now.
You know? We could just sell this for money.
Yeah.
So go to a beach somewhere.
His obsession causes his downfall, or, you know, at least his plan's downfall. He's still out there.
He's still egging.
Egging it on.
Yep. All right. Last one I want to touch on real quickly. And this will be real quick just because there's not much story here. So early Iron Man stories are real rough. I think still we don't have I don't think we've established any real significant Iron Man villains yet. And we're not going to this month either. So this one's called Iron Man versus Kala, Queen of the Netherworld. This story starts out with Tony Stark and his employees. They are captured by Kala, who is the queen of the netherworld deep under the surface of the earth. As she's kind of explaining her evil plan and justifications to Tony Stark, she says that her people are descendants of the inhabitants of Atlantis. That's why they are under the surface of the earth, because when the continent sank, their ancestors sank with it. She's decided, though, that it is time to return to the surface and conquer it. She enlists Tony Stark to make weapons for her. So this is basically exactly the plot of Iron Man's origin story, where villain captures Tony Stark, asks him to make weapons. He's like, yep, I'll totally do that.
Give me a lab.
Yeah. Like, give me a lab. Lock me away. Don't check on me for like a day or two.
Right. Totally going to do what you ask.
Yeah. So he, surprise, makes an Iron Man suit. Iron Man busts out. He defeats Kala's forces, and he shows her that they can't survive on the surface. He actually drags her to the surface, and she instantly ages like 50 years and becomes, I think she calls herself a wretched old hag. She's like, yeah, I can't live like this. And so he brings her back down to her people, she agrees to abandon her plans of conquest. Speaking of Atlantis, there's a much better Atlantis-related story. Let's take a quick break, and then we will jump into Fantastic Four Annual number 1.
So let's get into some media issues. This one is the meatiest issue of all time so far.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic Four Annual number one, Submariner versus the human race.
The whole human race.
I thought I was going to say torch every time I read it, and then it said race. So the stakes are a little higher than they were when, you know, Namor showed up in Strange Tales.
Yeah.
And did that blowfish thing that shall not be mentioned again, because this is the most epic story that Stan and Jack have attempted thus far. 37 pages long. Pages 2 and 3 are a double page splash spread.
Yeah. And that's two things that we have not seen so far. So no story so far, because there haven't been any stories that have been continued from one issue to another. So, you know, most of these stories, even if they're full book length, it's like 20, 22 pages at the most. So 37 is definitely a record. And we've never seen a double page spread in a Marvel superhero comic yet. So, yeah, they're pulling out all the stops.
They went big on this.
They did.
And speaking of big, Namor has found his people and is crowned King Namor the First of Atlantis. So he vows that the surface world will pay for its crimes against them. Lady Dorma is in love with him, much to the chagrin of Warlord Krang, all Atlanteans.
Yes, exactly. So the deal was, before Namor found his people again, this Lady Dorma was betrothed to Warlord Krang. But when Namor shows up again, she's like, but he's my true love and he's the one I want. Krang's not super happy about this at all, but you know, Namor's his king. What's he gonna do?
He gets in line.
Yeah.
So then there's some weird sightings of sea monsters. The FF decides to go on a cruise, like a vacation cruise, to investigate. And winds up captured by Namor. So he was luring them in.
Yeah. And there's some just awesome shots of the FF relaxing poolside. My favorite one is when you've got Ben Grimm hanging out with Alicia on the deck, and he's just like, he's wearing just giant clunky boots and like blue jeans and like a hooded sweatshirt that he's got the hood up.
Yeah,
you know, and he looks very comfortable, but he also does not look like he is on a cruise.
Arms behind his back, you know, sunglasses on.
Yeah.
Ben Grimm kicking it.
Yeah.
Deck chair. So I don't know why that happened. So they investigate this. Namor captures them. Namor tells them to tell the UN that the seas and skies above them, above all oceans, are his domain, and no ships or aircraft may pass through them.
Yeah. So that's a pretty bold grab. He's like, yeah, 3/4 of the earth, that's mine.
Right. You can have the rest. You're going to do some weird navigating, though. So
this is going to go off of like a flat earth rant where it's like, you know, Australia doesn't really exist. It's like you just fly up over Greenland.
Right. Yeah. It's connected.
Yeah.
So during Reed's address to the UN to tell them that, you know, what's up with Namor, we learn Namor's origin. His mother, Princess Fen, was of the species Homo mermanus. First contact was in the 1920s with Captain Leonard Mackenzie near the South Pole. They fell in love, and star-crossed lovers here, or sea-crossed lovers. They fell in love and married, but her father led his armies to take her back and killed Mackenzie in the attack. So Namor was born months later, possibly the first known mutant of our time, in quotes. Yeah.
It's the first time we've heard the word mutant in a Marvel comic, but not the last. And that's it. Literally, like, Namor is the definition of a mutant, where he has traits that neither one of his parents possess. So, you know, his mother is a blue skinned Atlantean. His father is a Caucasian male. So, I mean, Namor's got his father's coloring, but like neither one of them has little wings on their ankles.
Right.
You know, like they can't fly. Neither one of them had the super strength that he has.
One can breathe air. One can breathe in water. Right. Not either way.
Right. So, exactly. Yeah. And he can do both. I mean, he is literally a mutant. And it also kind of reinforces this idea of Namor as being, you know, he's got 1 foot in one world, 1 foot in another world, but he doesn't really belong anywhere.
Right.
Which I think really adds a lot of depth to the character.
Yeah. It starts to explain his, I mean, he is strong and but he is very stubborn and egotistical.
Yeah.
And part of that may be coming from some place of insecurity. I don't know. I haven't really set him down on the couch and talked him through it, but so Reed tells them that this declaration, Reed says that the UN must fight back against Namor.
Yeah.
Namor reveals himself as having been present the entire time. Another classic, you know, he was standing in the UN with a rubber mask.
Yeah. Yeah.
So here we are back at the UN getting tricked again.
And not only was he there the whole time, but the person who is giving Namor's life story is Namor in a rubber mask. Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's awesome because he's like, look, like, Let's have a little context for where I'm coming from here.
And then once Reed mentions, you know, we need to fight them.
Yeah.
He just pulls off the mask and is like, all right, war.
Yeah.
And he calls war. Namor's troops then invade New York City, which is crazy.
And I love some of these panels here, like just Kirby doing these just insane looking, awesome, like fins and curves on the vehicles. Like everything looks, it's all very mechanical and kind of futury, but everything is sort of informed by, you know, the design of underwater creatures.
Yeah.
And it's really pretty bright. Like it looks very, very alien. Alex Ross picks up on this in Marvels. And like he illustrates this whole invasion of New York. And I remember seeing that. And I think I may have seen that before I ever read this issue. And just thinking it's like, wow, this is so breathtaking. And then like I read this issue, it's like, oh, it was all here.
Right.
Yeah.
He just took more time to paint it dimensions.
Alex Ross is great. Don't get me wrong. But I mean, you know, he was working off of very strong material from the get go.
Yeah. So we have this massive Atlantean force coming in. How do they attack New York City? They wear helmets that have water in them.
Yep.
I almost did a Steve Brule. I almost said you dingus. So Namor's troops invade New York City. The FF can stop some of them, but not all of them.
Yeah.
So Reed invents a machine to evaporate the water in these helmets and drive them back into the sea. Basically, they don't have the ability to breathe. They need to get back in the water.
Yeah, and it takes Namor about 4 seconds to figure out who could have created a device that can do this. And he's not happy about it.
No, he's straight to the Baxter building.
Yeah.
So he attacks the FF. He kidnaps Sue, surprise.
Yep.
And brings her back to Atlantis with him. Lady Dorma is not stoked about this development.
No, not at all.
And Namor and the boys of the FF continue fighting.
Yeah, so this is, I think, the first time that Lady Dorma is aware of the fact that Namor is sweet on Sue. This comes as a pretty unpleasant surprise for her. She's made it really clear that she's in love with Namor. And I think she has just sort of at this point taken it on faith that he's going to wind up with her because they have a past, which they don't really get into, but it's implied. But then basically, what are you doing to bring this blonde chick in?
Right.
Yeah. And,
so she does a kind of boiling rabbit thing. She tries to drown Sue.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, not super hard when you're underwater already.
Yeah. So, and everyone else can breathe water except for, you know, your romantic rival.
Yeah. So cuts a hole in her, you know, cage room, and she floats out in the ocean and starts to drown. But Namor takes one of his own ships and gets Sue, brings her to the hospital, like rushes her there.
And that's the only way that she could get there fast enough to have her life saved. He couldn't have flown her fast enough. The FF couldn't have gotten her there. Johnny's flame, I think, is exhausted, or he can't fly fast enough or something. Anyway, it's made
Fantastic Car is trashed.
Right. Yeah. It's made really clear that the only way that she's going to make it is if Namor does this. And so he does.
But when he returns, his people have left.
Yeah.
So they were like, oh, cool. You want to save the blonde lady from, you know, the air breather.
Yeah.
And they all vacate.
Yeah.
So
it's like, wait, you just had us invade these people.
Right.
And then you did this. Yeah. So, yep.
It's kind of heartbreaking, weirdly, after seeing a person proclaim themselves a monarch and declare war on New York.
Yep.
The So that's the story, basically. It's Namor coming back. You know, it starts off with Namor triumphant as being crowned king of Atlantis and ends with him without his people again. So full circle, crushing.
Yeah. And the last lines of dialogue that Namor has in the story are, I mean, it's like Stan writing Stan Lee dialogue at his finest. And Namor says, and he's walking with his shoulders slumped, "Am I to be a king without a kingdom, a man without a home, more than a sea creature, yet less than human? Is there never to be a place for me on the surface or in the sea?"
Oh, it even rhymes.
I know, it's very Shakespearean. yeah.
It's nice.
Yeah. But yeah, great, great issue. It, like, epic in every sense of the word. Obviously, there will be bigger stories in the Marvel Universe, but up until this point, this is the biggest story. And it also ties in the Golden Age Marvel comics into the modern age really explicitly. Like, you're getting a lot of this Namor stuff was established in his character in the 40s, but this is the first time it's really being brought forward into the Silver Age. And so now you know, it's basically Marvel claiming its entire history, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. In a big way.
Yeah.
You know, he's returned a few times already, but it seemed like he could still be a visiting villain.
Right.
You know, this puts him at a totally different caliber. In addition, this annual is so awesome.
Yeah.
In addition, they reprint FF number one. So they're bringing people up to speed, which is very nice of them.
Yep.
They have full page bios and illustrations of all of the FF's villains up to this point.
Yeah. Even the Miracle Man gets even a page.
Which I was very surprised about.
I was too. Yeah. And Kurgo gets
Kurgo,
a page.
Yeah. Like, I'm like, yeah, Dr. Doom gets a page. Kurgo gets a mention. Kurgo. So then there's Q&A with the FF too, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Too.
Like, how do your powers work? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they explain a lot of things. Unstable molecules is often the explanation, because people are like, how do your clothes not catch on fire? Unstable molecules. How does it stretch? Unstable molecules.
Go away, kid. You're bothering me.
In fact, every parent should just use that from now on.
Yeah. Like,
why is broccoli green? Unstable molecules. we also get another Baxter Building cutaway, even more detailed than we've seen before, with the Save for Future reference call out.
But wait, there's more.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And then you get an expanded version of the very first meeting between Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four in Amazing Spider-Man number one, when Spidey shows up at the Baxter Building trying to get a job. And so both Kirby and Ditko work together on this, and they blow it out a few more pages and get a little bit more in there. It's great. Speaking of Spidey, the last thing that we are going to cover on this week's episode is going to be Amazing Spider-Man number 3. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Spider-Man versus Dr. Octopus. Welcome back. Last issue we're going to talk about this week is Amazing Spider-Man number 3. This is the debut of Dr. Octopus. This is a story I have probably read 20 times in my life.
Me too.
It is one of my very favorite Spider-Man stories. And I think it's really, it's Lee and Ditko at just really the peak of their powers. It's interesting. I think Spider-Man starts out really, really strong. And it stays there for quite a while. I think Lee and Kirby in Fantastic Four, early Fantastic Four stuff is good, but they really hit their stride 2, 3, 4 years into it. Whereas like the first year of Spider-Man is off the charts good.
Yeah, the human element of Spider-Man, I think, is what makes it so compelling.
I think you're absolutely right. And also, like, for whatever reason, like it feels like the first dozen villains that they introduce in Spider-Man, every single one of them is just a 5-star, like, the weakest of them is like the Chameleon, and who's still like, he's a decent villain.
He's no Kurgo.
Exactly.
I want to throw Kurgo under the bus more. This is really fun.
It can be a really tiny bus too, because he was small by the end of that story. This is the origin of Dr. Octopus. So the issue opens up with Spidey, and he's taken out some common street thugs And he's just doing it basically with, you know, one hand webbed behind his back. he's having no trouble whatsoever. And he actually says out loud that he wishes that it was more of a challenge. And you know, that's obviously going to be a huge jinx. Like, what are you doing, kid? So then we cut to Otto Octavius, Dr. Otto Octavius. He's working in an atomic research center. He's got these four mechanical arms that he can control with these dials on his chest. So he can stand behind heavy shielding to protect him from radiation while he's working on it. And these arms can basically be his proxies. So, of course, you know, when you've got four extra limbs and your name is Otto Octavius, everyone's going to call you Dr. Octopus.
Yeah, there's no way around that. It's also weird to see such a crazy contraption not from Kirby.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it is very not Kirby. It's like got some really more obvious like ways that you would manipulate these arms with the controls and things like that.
Yeah,
yeah.
So he's, you know, he's doing his thing. He's mixing those chemicals. Something goes terribly wrong. There's an accidental explosion. Otto is caught right in the heart of it. And the explosion fuses the arms to him, and winds up damaging his brain also. And this is a part of, Doc Ock's origin that I kind of forget sometimes. And this is something that gets picked up in, the Spider-Man movie where, you know, Octavius is a friend and a mentor to Peter Parker before the accident, but the explosion damages his personality, damages his brain, and that's what turns him to a life of bad.
And the panel of Doc Ock in the explosion, the Ditko drawing, it's like, again, it's this crazy contrasted, it's all red and black only.
Yep.
And it is beautiful. It is so cool and evokes such crazy action.
Yeah.
So, that one panel, and then just these like hooded hazmat workers getting him out of the debris, those two things together are just it's really great to see this contrast of the action the way Ditko draws it,
yes,
compared to what we would see from Kirby or anyone else.
Yeah absolutely. So he's been hit by this explosion. He wakes up in a hospital. The arms have been fused to his body. His brain has been damaged. He undergoes this radical personality shift. He's now belligerent. He's paranoid. And he realizes also he can mentally control the arms now. And he decides, I'm going to take over this hospital. So the news has started to leak out that something's going on. There was an explosion in an atomic laboratory. A scientist, Octavius, is at a hospital. Something's going on there. No one's able to get in or out. J. Jonah Jameson wants pictures of Octavius. And so he dispatches his ace photographer, Peter Parker, who heads over to the hospital as Spider-Man. Spidey sees that something's going on through the window. He's like, no big deal. Just crashes right through the window. He's like, I'm just going to take care of this. And Doc Ock absolutely annihilates this
messes
kid.
Him up.
Yeah. And it's like, it goes on for a little while too.
Oh, he gets at one point just held by all four arms and slapped in the face. Like insulting.
It's such a no contest.
Beat like down.
Yeah. It's over before it begins. Ock just throws him right out the same window that he came crashing in through. And Peter is so completely defeated that he's seriously considering just hanging up the webs and not being Spider-Man anymore. So Doc Ock, he winds up taking over the Atomic Research Center where he used to work. He busts out of the hospital, heads back over there. Peter is still super depressed. But in a coincidence, the Human Torch is in town because he was dispatched to go and try to solve this Octavius problem, but his flame is not is acting up. He's burned it out, and so he's got to rest and recover a little bit. So while he's doing that, he goes to Peter's high school and winds up doing a little pep rally.
Yeah it is pretty hilarious seeing Johnny, you know, in front of the kids, knowing he's like 16, and giving them a pep talk.
And it does the trick. The pep talk inspires Peter not to quit. And he actually like says something to Johnny right after. And Johnny's like, hey, what? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Whatever, kid.
Yeah.
It's just,
I'm glad you like the speech, fella.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He puts the red and blue on again, and he heads to the Atomic Research Center, and now it's time for round two. And this time he's going in, and he's going to be a little bit more serious about it. He winds up dodging and evading all of Doc Ock's traps and security measures. He sees a chemical laboratory. He's like, aha, here's I can do something with this because I am a genius scientist as well as being a superhero. He whips something up in some beakers, and then he takes that with him when he confronts Doc Ock, throws this formula at Doc Ock, who grabs it with his arms, and it has a chemical reaction that fuses two of Doc Ock's arms together. And then it's on. They go back and forth. Spidey's just fighting desperately, and he finally knocks out Doc Ock, and just barely.
Yeah. And keep in mind, Doc Ock, I mean, although he has mental control of some mechanical limbs, does not have like spider strength. So if you right. Once he gets in to punch him.
Yeah.
He can actually knock him out.
Yes, exactly. And that's exactly what he does. So he knocks him out. He webs him up, leaves him for the military police to take care of. And then the story ends with Spidey in full costume, tracking down the Human Torch and thanking him. Torch has no idea why he's doing that, but it is like a really cool bit of character and relationship building. And again, sort of continuing the developing, you know, friendship between those two that we saw coming up from last month.
Yeah.
So, it's really, really solid story. Like, I love the highs and lows of it. It takes you really on a pretty cool emotional journey. It's one of my very favorite Spider-Man stories.
And it's another villain that you don't hate. You don't root for Doc Ock,
right?
But you understand where he's coming from a little bit.
Yeah.
Although he does get a little megalomaniacal.
Yes. Just ever so slightly. Well, cool. I think, you know, we've gotten through our issues for the month, and now we just have the difficult task of picking out a panel that really sums it all up for us. So you mentioned my choice actually just a couple of minutes ago. So I'll just go ahead and do that one right now. So my panel of the month comes from Amazing Spider-Man number 3, page 9, panel 2. It's Doc Ock. Each of his four metal arms has one of Spider-Man's human arms.
Human limbs.
And he and Doc Ock is just slapping him across the face. It is just... the emotional impact of that, you're not used to seeing a superhero just get absolutely dealt with like that. I remember it made an impact on me, especially when I was much younger, but it is just such a great visual illustration of how completely outclassed Spidey is at this one moment. It's Ditko doing a really quiet thing. It's not, you know, someone being thrown through a wall. It's not having a mountain dropped on you. It's like, there's just nothing you can do. He's basically saying, like, stop hitting yourself. Stop hitting yourself.
Yeah.
That
is great. Yeah, that is and they set it up so well with him being cocky and then, you know, learning some more. I almost picked, as I mentioned, that awesome origin shot of Doc Ock.
Yeah.
Just with the explosion.
I did too. Yeah.
And that is worth looking at. If nothing else, just that panel is so good. But even better is this in this Fantastic Four Annual number 1, we have just this beautifully rendered Atlantis in that double page. I mean, I tried not to go for these big spreads sometimes, but this one, you can see that Kirby took his time. And as we joked, it was like 2 hours or something. he took time.
He works so fast. Yeah.
There is no line that is not thought about. Everything is so clean. It's very illustrative.
Yeah.
And it's just Atlantis. Like, it is awe-inspiring.
Yeah. And there's so many layers to it. Like, you've got these foreground layers. You've got Namor right in the midground, you know, dominating the left-hand side of it with his arm outstretched. And then, like, layers going into the background. It looks massive. It looks like a kingdom, which is exactly what it is.
It looks like what you would think from a scene from Wizard of Oz or something. Some big, like, huge cat scene. There's a giant, like, maybe it's a sculpture, but maybe it's just a giant sea serpent back there. And it is so illustrative and so designed. It really just, I was flabbergasted.
I remember in the early 2000s, like, it was really the term widescreen comics. It really came into a vogue. But it's like, this is the origin of widescreen comics. You know, it's this 2-page spread. Like you said, it looks like something out of a feature film of the era. Like, it's so good.
Yeah, it is. And the way color is used makes you, the edges are blues and you focus in on this golden throne with the red caped Namor.
Yeah.
It's so well done.
Yeah.
Cover work from Kirby is always cool and great. And there's usually a splash when you start a comic, but this is so much better and so much more well thought out. I mean, mm-hmm. better in that the lines are so clean, like yeah. everything about it. So yeah, I weirdly can't stop gushing about this. So good.
I totally agree. And it absolutely sets the tone for the story too. It's like, it's letting you know on pages 2 and 3, this is going to be an epic story.
Yeah.
This is big. This is bigger than anything we've done before. He's letting you know that right up front.
And if they're going to make, let's say Marvel's going to make a Fantastic Four movie sometime, this might be a really good topic to cover.
Might not be the worst thing. Yep. Cool. Awesome. Well, that brings us to the end of this month's comics. And I think it was a really solid batch. I was really pleased. It was always fun to go back and read these. We're so happy that y'all tune in every week and give us an excuse to do this. We'd probably be doing it anyway, but knowing that we've got folks who will start harassing us if we don't put something up on Wednesday, it's nice. It's a good, it's a kick in the pants to get us doing it. So
yeah, it gives us a more organized reason to talk about comic books.
Exactly. And speaking of talking about comic books, so Rose City Comic Con is coming up in Portland in just a few weeks, in the middle of September. And we're going to be there. We don't have a table or anything. We're not doing a show, but you're going to see us walk on the floor. We'll probably be wearing something that has the logo of our podcast on it. If you see us there, definitely say hi. We'll have swag in our pockets and have some cool stuff to hand out. We'd love to meet anyone who has been listening to this and find out who you are and what you think.
Yeah.
And also, you don't have to find us in person because, hey, we're all comics readers and sometimes we'd just rather do this over a computer screen or something. Follow us on Instagram. Marvel by the Month is the Instagram handle. Drop us a line anytime. MarvelByTheMonth@gmail.com. And you can always find us on the website, which has the rest of our social links, MarvelByTheMonth.com. Anything else?
No, we'd love to hear from you. So bring it on.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. My name is Brian Stratton.
And my name is Rob Milne.
And we will see you next week for next month.